Welcome to Living Healthy Together. This week, we're talking about legacy of medicine. Most of us know what it's like to go to see our primary care physician, to go see our specialist, to go into the hospital. Very few of us have ever experienced what it's like to found a medical practice and what it's like to see that medical practice endure across generations and be handed off practitioner to practitioner. So that's what we're doing today in this episode of Living Healthy Together. And I'm so excited. We're here on site at Green Mountain Family Practice in Northfield, Vermont, talking with Dr. Craig Sullivan and Dr. Matt Sullivan. You guys are part of a tradition in medicine that's been caring for families in this community for more than 100 years now. Dr. Sullivan, Craig, talk to me about the founding of this medical practice, the history, and if there is any, the mythology behind Green Mountain Family Practice.
Don't encourage me to talk about mythology. I'll create a lot. But as far as I know, the founding of the practice went back to the original doctor, Dr. Mayo, who founded Mayo Hospital, Mayo Nursing Home, their Vado Mayo Nursing Home. And he was a single practitioner back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the practice was handed over from Dr. Mayo to Elizabeth Parks, Scott Pedley, Ed Hyde, who came in just after World War II. They formed a group. That was the first group, and that was called the Green Mountain Clinic. They met as ski buddies up at Sugarbush. Dr. Pedley was from Rochester. Ed Hyde was practicing around the northern Vermont, and they decided to join in a clinic together. They practiced for a number of years until my partner, Kevin Crowley, came, and I believe he bought the practice from Dr. Hyde and Pedley in 1979 or 80. And then I came in when Kevin was working pretty hard, should we say, struggling to survive as a very, very busy solo practitioner in 1983. He and I founded our practice with a handshake, no paper. My perk was I was given the opportunity to name it Green Mountain Family Practice. That was it. And we moved on from there. Our partnership continued until he retired. And then I was practicing with two nurse practitioners and two MDs. There were a flurry of incidents where people left. And I was sort of the only man standing in a very, very busy practice. And got a phone call from Matthew one day, who was aware of my circumstances, where he was practicing out in Washington at that point, having finished medical school at UVM, a residency in Washington, and said, "Hey, Dad, you still looking for somebody?" I said, "Oh, you? Hey, send me your resume. I'll think about it." And then Matthew came on, and it was just delightful to be able to practice with him those years.
Was both of your entry into a family practice the same? When you came into this practice, were you an emerging physician? You had just completed your residency and you were new on the scene. And is that the same for you, Matt? Did you both enter the fray at the same point?
I'll start because mine's easier. My one and only job was here at Green Mountain Family Practice till the present. So 1983 till the present. That was it.
You did have an interesting connection in that during residency, you worked over at Sugarbush.
Correct. And that's when I did some exploring around, recognizing that I wanted to be in Vermont or in northern New England anyway. I had gone to Dartmouth and just always loved this area, and my wife did as well. And when I did a month working on the slopes over at Sugarbush for an orthopedics elective rotation, I looked around and heard that there was a guy who was desperately searching for a partner. And out of desperation, we had a conversation and a handshake, and we were off and running. So that was it.
Matt, talk about your entry into the practice.
I grew up in town because my dad was working here at the clinic. And let's just say many people assumed that I would follow in his footsteps. And I was convinced that would not be the case, that I would be doing anything but medicine. But mostly to prove everyone wrong. And eventually, my path led me back to medicine and ultimately family practice. I went to UVM for medical school, and then I went out to Seattle for residency. And that's where I got my first job And it was in a slightly different model of medicine. It was called a direct pay clinic where people would give a certain amount per month and they would have unlimited visits, unlimited x-rays, unlimited labs. And I was really attracted to that model of care and what it would do. So I was practicing in that sort of clinic when we were watching the temperature rising as a few people left this practice. And I was, or am married to a nurse practitioner. And so we were somewhat uniquely skilled to come and help out. So after a lot of family discussions, we decided to make the big move.
And it was a big move. I'm going to jump in as a footnote. When he was a junior in high school, I remember so distinctly him saying, "I only know two things. I will never be a doctor, and I will never be back in Northfield."
You never say never.
Teens are always right. Teens are always right. Yeah, I had great foresight, didn't I?
What drew you back to medicine? Because it seems like you had a really strong direction elsewhere.
Yeah. I ended up going to college, being an English major, and that actually led to film. So I was doing documentaries. And I found myself at one point in Bolivia, way out in the Andes Mountains, where you actually visited. I was doing a documentary about a local healthcare group and the system of health that they had. And we were looking at local healthcare workers who had minimal training in medicine, but knew their communities intimately. And we were tracking the efficacy of their work and just seeing them be incredible at driving excellence in maternal, infant, mortality rates, great tracking of healthcare throughout the community, and really just simply by being there and knowing the community, really driving excellent health. And that really sparked in me an idea. It just was amazing to me that could happen. And clearly, I thought back on my own life and seeing my dad's work and really having some understanding about that. But I couldn't help but get involved in the medicine at that point. I had been a rugby player and I was always drawn to the injuries and helping my friends out. And I knew that kind of deep down, that was a real passion of mine. And so that led me back to a post-baccalaureate program, which meant going back to UVM and taking kind of basic sciences and then applying to med school.
I think there was a moment when Matthew's in Bolivia that I went and visited with him and spent a week doing what he was doing and watching ambulatory physicians there or helpers walk into these tiny villages up in the sub-Andes, me walking around so short of breath at 15,000 feet, I couldn't see straight. And Matthew's going, "Come on, Dad, come on, catch up." But being able to see that and see these people go running into the homes when the worker arrived and see them pull out the same growth charts that I was using in my office for my pediatrics practice, to seeing how important it was for both the patients and the workers to be current, to be forward thinking about what was going on, and to see at that point that Matthew was being so impacted by this real life activity that would take him from a stance of "I'll never be a doctor" to "Wow, I can really imagine myself in this role. I can project myself doing this with people and helping out." It was an amazing moment for me as a father and a doctor to witness. It was great. My backstory is a little bit different, but parallels in that I also had no interest in science when I was in college. I had no interest in being a doctor. My father was a doctor. My grandfather, I watched them, the lives they lived. I said, "That is not for me." And so I went off. I was going to teach and do some other things. I traveled. I got back to the States a couple of years after graduation and said, "What am I going to do?" The only job I could get was working as an assistant in Metropolitan State Hospital for Children in Boston.
Let's be honest. That's what happens when you're a hippie living in a cave for 6 months in Greece. Yeah.
Let's say the resume didn't have to be too stacked for that job. The person who interviewed me said, "Do you have any sisters?" I said, "Yeah, I've got three sisters." He said, "Here's your keys. You're hired. You're starting in an hour." I went, "Oh, okay, what is this?" I worked in mental health, working with a lock-in adolescent unit for a couple of years there, where I met my wife. She was staff, not a patient. And then from there, I moved into another mental health job. And at that point, I was very frustrated with the level of care. And I said, "I should be in charge here." I thought I could do a better job in terms of just radar on the kids and seeing what was needed and developing plans and things like that. And I said, "What I don't have is credentials." So at that point, I said, "I'm going to be a psychiatrist." I went back to school, took all the post-bac courses, got into med school, and the same sort of thing with Matthew. I was so fascinated by medicine and what medicine was besides the psychiatric interest that I had. I said, look, if I do family medicine, I can combine, because family medicine, as we know, is a lot of psychiatry, a lot of back and forth with people, with stories, with listening, with seeing the before and the after, and doing that and having the medical side of things too. So for me, family medicine was a perfect fit.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back with Dr. Craig and Dr. Matt Sullivan, we're going to talk more about Green Mountain Family Practice and their journey through the years caring for this community. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. We're here at Green Mountain Family Practice exploring the legacy of medicine and how medical practices originate, how they exist across generations, and how they pass from practitioner to practitioner. You guys are part of a long history of medical doctors, four generations back. We've done a lot of backstory, but we haven't gone back further than you, Craig. So talk about your father, your grandfather. What's it like having all of that history? That's a lot of weight.
It was always just part of the weave. It was part of my family weave. It was always there. Medicine was always important. There was always a black bag everywhere I went. I was in my father's car, my grandfather's car, on the tables at family celebrations. Somebody's black bag was always around. And it got used, by the way, frequently. And so it was always part of what we did. It was never appreciated as anything grandiose. It was what they were doing. My grandfather practiced solo practice in Hartford, Connecticut, and just took care of everybody, did home births, did just a ton of things like that. My dad, my uncle, and another uncle who was an internist, another uncle who was a plastic surgeon, they practiced. They all got drafted in the middle of their training in World War II. They all took on wartime jobs. My dad ran a prisoner of war hospital in Iceland for 3 years. My uncle was in Iwo Jima as a surgeon. And so there were so much stories, but they never talked about that. They never talked about the war. And the stories that we served were just about the day-to-day. And my father was there, and mom would say, close the door, leave him alone. He's got to talk to a patient. And listen to that. I remember my dad, house calls in the morning, office in the afternoon, hospital before and after, and then home. And he hit the door at home, and he was involved with the kids, and that was it. It was always part of our life, and we never knew any other way. Sadly, it's probably the same for
Matt. So that's what I want to hear. Matt, was your experience growing up the same, or did it change? Did it evolve for you?
It's interesting. I mean, I often think about this, because what your grandfather did compared to what I do on a daily basis is so wildly different. Not only home births, but appendectomies. And he removed gallbladders. Like, he did just amazing things to me in his practice in the hospital as part of being, at that point, a general practitioner. And then we heard about what your dad did just in the hospital, in people's homes all the time, and in his practice, and spending a lot of time doing that. And then I experienced your practice, where you were one of two providers covering a pretty large catchment area. So you were on call every other day, every other holiday, every other weekend. And you being on call was very different for me and what I experienced being on call, because you would have to go to the hospital if one of your patients had to be admitted. So you would go there, and that would take up quite a bit of time. I hear many stories. I think many people with parents for doctors have very different experiences. It was framed for us, I'm talking about my siblings and I, that we were part of the team that was taking care of the community. Clearly, there was some sacrifice, but we were doing it for our friends and neighbors. And that was a very real thing that we could feel when we walked around town. People were very grateful. So it was something that kind of was very tactile. You could see in the community, you could see how much it was appreciated. You could see that there was something meaningful there. And so I think it helped with some of that time, etc. But I do remember you always made time to come to sporting events, etc. Like, you're very busy, but did carve out a lot of time for family. I reflect on what those differences are. And then for me, I think it still works out to probably about the same amount of time spent, but we are doing very different things. And the job of being a family practitioner is so immersive and so involved that there will always be sacrifice of the family of the person who's doing it. And so how that's framed and how involved they are, and I think how much they can viscerally feel that, is always important.
You say team, and that just illuminated something for me. It's really true. I don't think of it in that term, but what my practice, my work, was really a team effort. Impossible without my wife, who sacrificed so much in terms of time, her own career, and she was a special ed educator and took care of her kids. But as part of that, I can remember coming home a number of times on Christmas Day, having to do admissions, stuff over the hospital, things busy, covered for people, and coming in at 5 or 6 o'clock, and all these kids would be sitting there just, can we open our presents now, Dad? I mean, so, and they would just hold off and just say, Yeah. And so that whole thing, and to be honest, they lived in a fishbowl. This is a small town. Kevin and I took care of everybody for the most part, and everybody knew our kids and they knew they were being watched. And so there was an extra sort of pressure, but not really. It was because it was just very positive. I think the sense of our town, Northfield, they're very appreciative as patients in that town. They could come here and we would try to provide as much care as we possibly could in the building. We weren't shipping them off to specialists. We weren't shipping them off during the night and on weekends, whatever. We were doing our best to take care of them within the limits that we could. So I think it was very special, but it wasn't without sacrifice and a little awkwardness or difficulty at times. If they ever tripped and stumbled, people would like, a little bit of that. But at the same time, they're more than willing to come up and say, you got great kids. And I would get that kind of feedback about my family because everything's so small here.
I've lived in small towns almost my entire life. And you say, you know, everybody knows you. And that's true to a large extent. But then when you're part of the family that's caring for the entire community, that's a whole nother level of implicit and explicit scrutiny, even if it's not judgmental scrutiny. Everyone's got their eyes and ears open in a different way because of this special relationship that you guys have as physicians that are responsible or invested in health and wellness of everybody in town.
Yeah. And I would say that's overwhelmingly positive.
Yes.
Like I agree. Part of this story of changing medicine and family medicine is that I was in a residency with 12 other people who were some of the most incredible individuals I've met in my life. Just astounding people. And only 4 of the 12 are continuing to practice kind of full spectrum family medicine as I am now. And that's a story nationally. There are fewer and fewer people doing this work because it's very challenging. And I think the challenges have remained the same, but also have evolved over time. But I think the connection with my community and what that means and people's appreciation for that is incredibly protective for me in that way. It has protected me from the level of burnout that I see all around me and nationally. So we're talking about the heavy lift that it is to do this job and all the hours that it requires and the intensity. I'm a bit biased, but it might be the most special job in the world. You're invited into people's lives in the most intimate ways, and you are involved in the most intense moments in people's lives. And to then go forward with that type of relationship with somebody over time is just something that can't be measured, that is so special, that's beyond the page, beyond anything that's written down. It's probably why you get into this job, and there's nothing like it.
And for me now to be on the outside looking in, walking around town, hardware store, grocery store, something like that. People came up to me and so they were my patients for 40 years to say, docs, I always loved you. You're the best doctor, but your son's way better than you were.
It kills me.
I tell everybody to tell you that, right?
Yeah.
It kills me. I said, are you taking your medicine today? But it's such a source of pride for me. And it's so gratifying to see that the relationships between myself and patients, and we both honor and thrive on relationships. Both Matthew and I know that, talked a ton about that. To see the way he values those relationships, the story that people tell, how it evolves, and being there for people is just so important to me and so gratifying to see. Both my new boss and my son doing that is tremendous. So it's really important to get that kind of feedback and that kind of positive sense from people.
I think a lot of times when people think legacy, they think brick and mortar, or they think of a professional reputation. But this is interpersonal relationships that are handed off generation to generation and person to person. That's incredible. And I don't know of any other profession where that happens. I'm sure there are. But this is the first time I'm actually thinking about that and hearing about it and seeing it in my mind's eye. And that's amazing. We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. We'll be right back with Drs. Craig and Matt Sullivan after this. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're here in Northfield, Vermont, talking to Drs. Craig and Matt Sullivan. We're talking about the legacy of medicine, the legacy of family practices and medical practices. We've talked a lot about the personal journey that you have gone through in your careers and across generations. Let's talk about how the practice and how medicine has evolved over that same time. Craig, the easy joke that everybody makes in any healthcare meeting I've ever been in is change is the only constant in healthcare. And I know that's true, but it also gives short shrift to the way that medicine advances and changes. The practice operated in one way for so long. Take us back. How did this used to work?
I think Northfield as a town had an expectation that they didn't like to leave town when I first got here. And there was an expectation that healthcare would happen here and we'd do everything we possibly could. Matthew and I changed notes a lot of the time. He claims I practiced in the Wild West. And there was a little bit of that, a lot of house calls, a lot of hospice care that happened at home. And we did a lot of surgeries and fracture repairs and casting and this and that. There aren't many primary care offices these days that have a cast saw. And I always look around for one here. Doing that was really important. We did our own x-rays because of that. We had dip tanks and a nurse was running back and forth, rooming patients, going to the dip tanks, putting things in fixer and developer and hanging a rope across our lead-lined closet that we'd shut the doors behind so we wouldn't expose the film, hang the films up, go back and see a couple of patients and go in and look at that. And as Matthew points out, Norwich Ski Hill was right behind us. And I'd go out and take a couple runs at lunch whenever I could. And sometimes the ski patrol guys would just ski people literally into our back door and lift the stretcher up and throw them on the x-ray table because they knew somebody had busted an ankle and needed to be done. We did a lot of the ER stuff that gets done now because there weren't ER doctors back then, or there were, but it was very scanty. It was usually sparsely populated in terms of professionals. And so we did a lot of the repairs and a lot of the trauma work that doesn't get done now in the primary care office. Some of it does, but a lot of it doesn't. And it was an expectation from town, which has changed over time. There's so many more specialists practicing now than when I came. So I think that's a major swing in what's happened.
As I see the practice being part of a local hospital, which is embedded in an academic medical network, I've got to say the expectation in town hasn't changed. We still do our best to give as much care as possible here. And I think we really go out of our way to do that. I'd still do house calls. I still do hospice care in home. So a lot of that is possible. But yeah, the ER is wildly overused now. And there are urgent care clinics, which never used to exist. Now there are hospitalists who take care of patients in the hospital. 40 years ago, that was unheard of. Right. It was all family medicine docs taking care of their own patients in the hospital. And I think that has changed over time due to looking at data and looking at the quality metrics around specialization, and people who do that work all the time probably have better outcomes, but that's a different experience for patients too. And so I think we're really working hard at how to
maintain that relationship, which is different. I hear from patients all the time that, like what you did, you saw them in the hospital, you were at their home, you're there for their parents' death, you're there for the child's birth. That kind of presence is invaluable in patients' lives. And I think what we're trying to do is figure out what presence means in our community now. And I think absolutely, like face-to-face, you just can't fake time with another person. That is going to always be the coin of the realm. But there are many ways that you can connect with people, whether that's simply messages over the computer, and it's so nice to be able to connect with your doctor, just being able to shoot them a message, or maybe doing a video visit or a quick visit in the office, or I see them in the grocery store still, or at the hardware store, whatever it is. I don't think community expectations have changed wildly, although, yeah, medicine has changed and how we do things have changed and how people think about that has also changed. But I think the heart of it, connecting with a patient and letting them feel that they have a home within a wildly complex world of medicine, that they have a home here and someone who knows them, that will never be old. That will never be passé. And so figuring out how to do that over time is really our work and something that is an ongoing kind of evolution.
Time is the coin of the realm. Where'd you get that from, Matthew? It was pretty good. And it's really, I got to admit, it's really true. Because if you don't spend the time with patients measure sometimes the value of the relationship they have with you and the value of the care by time spent, because nothing can substitute for that. And whatever changes we make going down the road, whatever forward thinking is going on, that time has to be valued. The more you're shortcutting time, the more you are compromising the relationship in the eyes of the patient, even though we might say, I don't need to spend an extra 10 minutes talking about your cholesterol. It's more than that. It's complex and it's important to the patient. So it's a great point.
It is a great point. And it's a fascinating conversation. Society has changed and become less formal. Medicine is interacting with patients differently, and doctors are interacting with patients differently. Patients experience society and society's expectations differently. So does that change the way that they meet you? Does that change the way that they talk to you?
I think society evolves over time. And what is an appropriate relationship with another person or another professional absolutely changes with time. I think the important piece that doesn't change is that you're there to both hear someone, to be paying attention, and then to give them something valuable out of that. That expectation from the patient coming into an office will never change. That fundamental kind of relationship and what is going on in the office will never change.
I think that's really comforting to hear, because to me, we, and maybe I'm wrong about this, have become a less serious society. There's misinformation. There's an influencer that's trying to sell you fish oil pills that are going to detox your pancreas on TikTok, and people buy that. The model for medicine, for the doctor-patient relationship, has changed, I would say. Even when I was a kid, I remember you entered a doctor's office as an empty vessel ready to be filled up with information and knowledge and marching orders for how to recover or protect your health. And now what we tell patients is you need to come in with your top three questions. You need to be prepared to talk to your doctor and to be honest with them and to tell them the things, and they have to be ready to listen to you. At least it seems to me that these are very different models for the way that this is supposed to work.
You make a great point. And I think the old model of medicine was much more what is called paternalistic. And that has evolved over time. And I think for a major benefit for everybody, for both the patients, but also for the providers. I think the relationships are a two-way street. And I'm talking about how to improve experience for patients, but man, this is also about how those relationships are improved for me. And so I think being more open kind of over time and working on someone's health together, I think that actually improves health outcomes. And there's some data around that. So I think that we can learn. I think that we can improve as a society. Whether that is more TikTok or not is something to be questioned. But
Luddites is the world unite.
I think that relationships and good relationships with each other will never get old. What is normal has evolved, and that's probably a really good thing. And so
that is the business of family medicine, is figuring out how to stay current, how to best meet patients where they are. And that's exactly what the work is right now. So I think whether you want to call it an increasing informality, I think that's just how we speak with each other now. And that's how relationships really are. So meeting people where they are, that's what it's all about.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back with Drs. Craig and Matt Sullivan, we're going to talk about primary care and the investments they see as necessary and urgent to address the challenges of maintaining and recovering health and wellness. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're here in person in Northfield, Vermont with Drs. Craig and Matt Sullivan of Green Mountain Family Practice. We're talking about the legacy of medicine, the legacy of family practices and medical practices. Craig, what were the most impactful ways that medicine changed from when you came into this practice to when you handed it off to your son?
Sadly, the most impactful thing was that medicine slowly became a business rather than a practice. And by its nature, it had to change. The only insured patients I had when I started were teachers and municipal workers. Everybody else paid cash. We billed everybody, and that was it. And so it evolved over time that it became more and more business-oriented as insurance plans started hitting and everything started going on. And we had to hire more people around that, which is why my wife got involved in the practice. She became office manager, started off doing payroll, and then the books, everything else. And that whole side of the human resource side and the business side evolved so much. And I always thought I was a pretty good doctor, but I was a pretty terrible business person. There's no doubt about that. And so that piece is the biggest change. And then clearly the business models and the insurers began dictating the algorithm for how medicine should be practiced, and medicine changed on that basis.
How long did it take for that to happen? Is there an inflection point that lives in your head?
Yeah, the inflection point was when we couldn't pay ourselves for a lot of weeks because we just didn't have money coming in because we didn't have the ability to keep up with a lot of the changes, keeping up with denials and everything else. I think it took about 20 years for it to evolve to the point where we said, boy, we ought to start looking at what we're going to do down the road because we're not going to be able to afford to even stay open because Northfield is not an affluent community. We had a tremendous number of Medicare patients, people who were paying out of pocket. And so it was just hard to keep up. We always had volume. We always had a lot of patients, a lot of grateful patients, a lot of pathology, but keeping up with the change and having to invest in electronic medical records and more of that, that's a lot of the difficulty. And then that was driving some of the medical care at that point.
How did that filter down to patients? When and how did they start feeling it? My sense is, if I'm going to guess, you probably spent a lot of time, years probably, insulating your patients from seeing and feeling your changes.
Yeah, we probably overcompensated a bit. I suspect we really did. We never sent a bill collector after anybody. We tried to maintain the relationships first. And my partner was very strong on that. And we were very strong on that. And so patients always knew they could get care, but it came with a cost business-wise. But I don't think it really changed the practice of medicine. We always tried to be thorough. We always tried to be present and available for people. And when I think people felt that in the end, we had bills to pay and they had to pay us, and people that didn't have insurance, it would be more and more of an eye opener as things went on, how much care was costing. You'd say, what this cost now? And I get that, but
also we had a stand up freezer that was full to the gills with maple syrup at all times from those who could not afford their bills, and a whole lot of local art around our house.
Right. Yeah, it's true. It's true. So there was more than a bit of bartering that went on, for sure.
Matt, what was it like for you to enter that ecosystem, already having quite a bit of context, seeing how it developed and was built?
Yeah, I think I did have a bit of a head start seeing that and seeing the evolution of my dad's practice. I think going through education, understanding a little more history around medicine, I saw that inflection point happen with reimbursements. And that's a fancy way of saying how much insurance companies would pay for a certain service. And primary care reimbursement has historically been the lowest. Of all the services, primary care gets billed very low. And that in itself put primary care practices that were incredibly busy working their tails off in a place where they simply could not make money. And so because of that, as my dad's saying, there is incredible pressure around ultimately selling the practice because there is no way to make money on your own. And really the way that family medicine became valuable was when it was connected with a hospital and it could be a source of driving down cost over time by providing excellent preventative care. You could drive down costs for the hospital itself, or it would be a source of referrals for labs or imaging, et cetera. So the hospital could make money from primary care in a way that the practice itself couldn't. So it had to become part of the ecosystem of healthcare in order to survive. So that set up a lot of dynamics in that suddenly when family practices, individual providers who are used to running the business and the medicine suddenly were no longer the owners. They lost a lot of control over who they would bill and who they wouldn't. And so I think the community felt that change. And for our community, that was around 2007 when I think Green Mountain Family Practice was sold to CVMC, Central Vermont Medical Center, hospital up on the hill.
Yeah.
And what that does is it creates a different dynamic for the providers because suddenly they're salaried. They're not making money as individuals or they're not controlling that, but suddenly they're paid by a bigger organization. And that just changes incentives incredibly. And what that billing process is called at a greater level is fee for service. That means you pay money for each type of service that you're provided. So you pay for one x-ray, you pay for one MRI, you pay for one visit to the doctor. And so the incentives for the health system are to churn out those individual services. So if they're going to make money, the incentive is to have more patients go through the practice or to have them take part in services that are a little more expensive, whether that's MRIs or endoscopies. That's the incentive. I'm not saying that's what always happens, but when money is involved, it's a powerful mover. And so when I went through medical school and in my training and residency, I really saw that. And that's why I chose to go to a different form of care where the payment was a little bit different. Once a month lump sum, so you're not incentivized to have a patient necessarily come in all the time, or you could if needed. So that incentive around money was different. That's how I saw it when I was going through my education.
What are the investments, whether they are investments we can make right now or investments that we have to work towards making that can address the fundamental issue at hand, which is not enough people have preventative care, not enough people have primary care, and the system doesn't value it the way that it should. Not the health system necessarily, but the American model for healthcare in general.
It's a great question. And one thing that I think is really going to be crucial is providing value and recognition of the importance of primary care to the people who might have an interest in coming through the educational process and going into primary care. It has to be valued by the system. It can't be the last rung on the ladder of pay and be burdened with time and be burdened with all the administrative detail, which I see happening now. So much of the busy work and the checking of boxes and everything else is falling back on the backs of the primary care people. So much of the secondary burden of medicine is being dumped back into primary care. And until that's relieved, the system is just going to continue to deteriorate because people aren't going to go into family medicine. They hear about it on rounds in medical school. They hear about it when they're choosing their residencies. And people keep saying, why would you want to do family medicine when you could go into plastics? And it's not judging anybody. And I get it. A lot of people want to have a different sort of life than what family medicine can lead to sometimes. And I know Matthew, my life as a practitioner was far different than his, whereas maybe I would be going in at night and seeing patients in the office and meeting somebody. But he's on the portal and on his phone and looking up and checking back on his inboxes for 6 hours at night, 2 in the morning. I think
there's a recognition of the importance of primary care, but there's not a recognition of how difficult it is and how you need to value it to get great people studying medicine to go into primary care.
I do media relations too, so I talk to reporters all the time. I pitch stories, AI, a bridge, reducing the administrative burden, reducing burnout. That's all well and good. But Matt, what your dad is talking about, AI can't help with that. Being on the portal, checking your email, writing messages, interacting with patients at all hours. AI is not going to fix that. How do you deal with it? And is burnout something that is just a fact of life and can't be solved because of the nature of the job? Or is there something else that we can do rather than just saying technology will fix it?
Well, you're asking a bit of a million-dollar question here. What can we do to save and preserve what is important in family medicine? And I don't mean to say that family medicine is at all more important than any other specialties. There is absolutely an important place for every single type of medicine. I think primary care and family medicine have a special place in that. Dad, you're right. I'll say that, and that might be the first time I've ever said that. So much does tumble down to primary care in terms of our responsibility. And honestly, I want that. I want that because being in the trenches with people really is where the relationships are. And things have evolved over time in terms of how you meet a patient where they are. We call that access now. Not everybody needs to come into the office. Many people we see virtually, and many people I'm just talking to through the portal. And that's where people want to be met. And I don't want to reduce that. If anything, I want to increase that because that's how we can be successful, because there's so much that we can do there. The issue is that we just really don't have time in our day to do that. And so we're being asked to fit it in into all the nooks and crannies of our lives. And that, I think, is the source of burnout. So we really need to find a way for all of those things to be done in a more reasonable fashion. There's a lot of people thinking creatively about that right now. There's a lot of different solutions that may be on the horizon. There are ways to be looking at people's health passively. We're setting up something called the PHSO, which is a fancy way of saying we've got care managers who are working with patients directly on tough social issues, but also taking a look at indicators of health like diabetes. How bad is it? Can we get the people with really uncontrolled diabetes into the office, or at least just get tested and talk to them on the phone and different strategies about diet? Can we get people with high blood pressure to change your medication over the phone, or come in for blood pressure readings, or somebody with heart failure to come in more often to the clinic or to adjust their diuretics? And this is all without the provider being involved. So there's a multimodal way to meet patients where they are that doesn't have to be frontline in the office seeing the provider. I think what you're hearing here is there really isn't a boogeyman out there. Insurance companies are really important in how our healthcare system works. And I know many people who are working really hard inside insurance companies to keep people healthy. Hospitals need to make money to keep the doors open. That really is real. And so I think there is a balancing act that needs to happen, but everyone needs to come together and have a better conversation about it. Vermont's a small place, and I think we can really impact healthcare here if we have a positive conversation. And I've actually been really encouraged by what I've seen over the last 6 months in our state.
I think folks often want things to be black and white. There's a bad guy, there's a good guy, there's a problem. That's not the way the world works. And two things can be true at the same time. The system can be broken, but the organizations and the people within the system can still be good and can still have good intentions. And that's what we just heard from Matt. Just because things aren't working, or just because they're broken, or just because there are acute issues right now and people disagree, that doesn't mean that there's a bad guy and a good guy. It just means that people need to get together and find a better way to talk about it.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the real examination needs to be around the incentives that exist in a system, because everyone is incentivized to act a certain way. And so they will, whether it's insurance companies trying to save money in certain ways and sending me prior authorizations that I have to work on for hours each day, or hospitals who are trying to charge a certain amount of money because they need to keep their doors open. Everybody is incentivized to do a certain thing. And what we need to do is create incentives in our system that will lead to quality care, lower costs, and patients feeling like they are seen and heard again.
We've talked about a lot of really heavy topics, a lot of stuff that probably feels overwhelming to folks and might make them feel like this conversation is unmoored from everyday life. So I want to bring it back to the personal to close us out. Matt, you brought a picture. Explain what these two photos are, who is in them, and why this is important. We've talked before, and you told me that you look at this photo while you're working, while you're thinking about patients and making medical decisions as a doctor.
When I graduated from residency, my dad gifted me this photo. One frame shows him and his brother standing looking a little stiff in front of a fireplace. And
the order got tied.
Don't wear. Yeah. A tie shaped like a fish. So let's not try.
It's a good tie.
Yeah. Yeah. You were trying real hard. The photo above it is my grandfather and his and your brothers and my great grandfather. And so I think I was relaying that oftentimes in my day when I'm encountering something on any level, whether it's tragedy, whether it's amazing joy, frustration with the system. I'll often take a peek up at this. Think about what my grandfather, Appa, would be doing or thinking in this circumstance, what his day was like, what he had to deal with, and then what I'm dealing with. And I think about the common thread that has to exist between those four generations of people practicing medicine and the heart and soul of what was important to people then absolutely is what remains important now. And I think about how I can maintain that tradition and really what that legacy is that's been gifted to me and something that I need to protect. And it's funny, this summer I had a chance to actually read his obituary, and it was funny in that the description of him actually, I think, could be something that was applied directly to me as well. Somebody who just thrived in his relationships with other people and how much he cared and joked around with his patients. And this is from somebody back in like the 1920s practicing medicine. And it's just funny how that 100 years later, that kind of remains the same.
That is a wonderful story.
There is something very powerful that runs through there. And I think it's the recognition by all the people, my uncles, my grandfather, his brother, my brother, Matthew now, that there's no greater privilege vocationally than to practice medicine, as far as I'm concerned. It's just wonderful. And family medicine in particular, it values the relationship. It values the story. It values the conversation. It values the highs and the lows. Who else gets to be part of helping a family deal with the death of somebody, being at bedsides and dealing with that, and then being at the bedside when babies are born? We get the entire spectrum of cradle to grave in a way that's just unique, and we can laugh and cry through the whole thing. It's just, for me, it was always a great fit. And I think for the people in the photos and for Matthew, it's a great fit. And the recognition that medicine is an art, it's a privilege, and it's just a wonderful vocation to be able to share with people.
Gentlemen, this has been fascinating. We didn't cover half of what I thought we were going to cover, and I'm so glad for it. Thank you for making space in your day at your practice for this conversation. This is Living Healthy Together. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thank you to Dr. Craig and Dr. Matt Sullivan of Green Mountain Family Practice. We'll see you next time.